Hello, folks. Welcome to the March 2020 edition of First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or an hour or so while we go over recent developments in the public safety workplace. I've just got a couple of quick administrative things that I want to talk to you about, and then I want to dive into the cases because we have six of them this month, and boy, they are interesting ones. So the administrative things first. First of all, I hear from people from time to time who subscribe to our newsletter, who listen to these First Thursday podcasts, but who don't know that with our newsletter subscription, the subscription to Public Safety Labor News, you get the premium podcasts for free. And you do. That's the package that we put together. You not only get the premium podcasts if you subscribe to the newsletter, you also get PDF copies of a whole bunch of different books and other goodies. So if you are, in fact, a newsletter subscriber and you can't get enough podcasts in your life, there's an opportunity. You can just get our second premium podcast, almost always an interview podcast, where I'll interview somebody who's out there doing the work in the field. And you can get that just with your newsletter subscription. Second thing I want to mention is we've got our wellness and fitness seminar that we have scheduled in Nashville in April. You can find out about it on our website, LRIS.com. I only mention this because we are definitely going to sell out in that sell out the seats, not sell out our integrity, sell out the seats that are available in that seminar room. We have about 85% of the seats sold, and we're still a month and a half away. So if you want to get to that seminar, you better register for it soon. So with that, let's get into the cases, and let's start with a Fire Department of New York case on facial hair and what the court ends up calling, I love these two phrases, the empty vessel of light duty and the driving calculus of bureaucracy. Boy, you see those phrases, and you know you're going to like the court's opinion, no matter how it comes out, I mean, no matter what the result is. I read so much in the way of dry court decisions out there that when you have a judge who actually can put pen to paper or fingers to keyboard and come up with something that is creative, you just love it. And that's the case here. It's also, I think, a pretty important case. So beyond the fact I like the writing. So this is a case involving four firefighters for the Fire Department of New York. One of them goes by the name of Salik Bey. They are all African-American men who were employed by the fire department for many years. All four of them suffer from a condition that's known as pseudofolliculitis barbae. I'll probably call it PFB when I talk about this case. That's a physiological condition that causes disfigurement of the skin, inflammation, in the hair-bearing areas of the chin, cheek, and neck. Grossly, disproportionately affects African-American men. It affects approximately 45 to 85% of African-American men. No other racial group is even in double digits. So this has a significant adverse impact on the basis of race. And most importantly, for the purposes of our case, PFB is exacerbated by shaving with a razor down to the skin. It makes it much worse. Okay, so that's the background. Now, under the department's what's called respiratory protection standard, firefighters who are entering an area that has the potential to be dangerous to life or health all have to wear self-contained breathing apparatus. When that requirement came into place, and because of their skin condition, the four firefighters sought a medical accommodation from the department that would allow them to maintain closely cropped facial hair uncut by a razor. Sometimes these are called shadow beards. They go by a variety of different names. The department did the right thing, subjected the firefighters to a fit test that was designed by OSHA to make sure that their mask had the proper seal and that the firefighter was breathing from the air in the tank and not anything else that might be contaminated. The mask passed the fit test when it was worn by firefighters who had this closely cropped facial hair. And so in 2015, the department granted the requested accommodation, and these four firefighters were allowed to have these very short beards. There were subsequent follow-up fit tests that were administered by the department and a bunch of reports from the field, and everything indicated it all worked. So why do we have a lawsuit, right? Everybody's happy. The department's happy. The firefighters are happy. The public is happy. And everyone's happy. Except in 2018, we have an acting chief of safety for the department who looks around and says, I need something to do. Actually, that's not in the court opinion. That's just my opinion. And he revokes the medical accommodation and orders the firefighters to shave their beards or be reassigned to light duty. The firefighters sue, and they say the revocation of the accommodation violated the Americans with Disabilities Act. And this ends up with a federal court in New York. And it ends up at what's known as the summary judgment stage. I use phrases like summary judgment from time to time, and I realize I don't explain them. What summary judgment means is who's ever filing a summary judgment motion, and sometimes it's both sides, right? Who's ever filing a summary judgment motion is saying to the court, okay, we got a trial out there somewhere in the future. But the facts of the case are undisputed. All we have is a legal argument, and we win on the legal argument. So summary judgment is a way of shortcutting a trial in cases where there's no honest dispute as to what the material facts are. So this case comes before the court on summary judgment, a summary judgment motion that is filed by the department. And the court goes down the usual approach of how these ADA cases are considered. The first question is, because we're under the ADA, is whether or not these firefighters are suffering from a disability. And the court says, well, that's easy, because they're certainly perceived as having a disability here, and they also suffer from a major or limitation, substantial limitation, in a major life activity. What's the major life activity that their disability causes them to be substantially limited? The ability to groom, which is listed by the EEOC as a major life activity. So step one, firefighters potentially covered by the ADA. Then we get to step two, the department's answer to that. And the department says, hey, firefighters aren't precluded from shaving. They only, and I'm quoting, cannot shave with a razor down to the skin because of PFB. And therefore, there's no substantial limitation on their major life activity of grooming. The court isn't buying it. The court says, PFB significantly restricted the manner in which the firefighters shaved. It's reasonable to conclude that the limitations in grooming experienced by the firefighters are not likely to be encountered by the average person. Now we get down to where the real action is in the case. We've got four employees who have a disability, and the next question is, can the employer reasonably accommodate the disability, because the ADA requires employers to reasonably accommodate a disability. And the court says, yeah, absolutely, on the reasonable accommodation issue. These firefighters were reasonably accommodated. Nobody thought there was a problem with they're going to fire scenes wearing these masks. They passed the fit test. It wasn't an issue until we had this acting chief who simply changed the rules. Then the department brings out its kind of last gasp argument here. And the last gasp argument is that these firefighters, you know, we just assigned them to light duty. We didn't fire them. So we didn't take adverse action against them. And therefore, they don't have any claim under the ADA. And this is where the court waxes eloquently about the whole issue of firefighting. Here's what the court says. I'm going to read you about two or three sentences. Ample evidence in the record indicates that the essential function of the job the firefighters were hired to do was to respond to fires and other emergencies, an admired position of service to the public. By contrast, the assignment to light duty was an empty vessel of opportunities to carry out these tasks, an accommodation allowing the firefighters to put their lives at stake to fight fires and protect the public from dangers, rather than seeming to shirk these responsibilities, would be a reasonable accommodation. Here, placement on light duty effectively demoted the firefighters to second-rate firefighters. So there you see the court finding that, in effect, putting someone on light duty is a demotion. I'm not 100% convinced of that unless you can show that there's some economic impact on the firefighters. And the court doesn't get into the whole issue of whether there's an economic impact, and there might well be, right? Loss of overtime, loss of premium pay. You can imagine several. And for whatever reason, the court doesn't discuss that issue and instead just treats the placement on light duty as a demotion because of the way the firefighters would be viewed by their peers and the public. Now let's get to the court's closing comments. And they're not so much relevant for a legal issue as they are to give you the court's mindset. And let me tell you, when you're arguing these cases, particularly, you know, sometimes these technical sorts of cases, and ADA cases can be really technical. Fair Labor Standards Act cases can be really technical. Your job as a lawyer is to get out there and to humanize the whole situation for the court. So the court understands that these sometimes fairly complicated legal tests, that they have real live consequences for people and their work lives. And you can tell by what the court writes here that the court gets that. So what is it that the court, how does the court end its opinion? I'm going to quote three sentences. The department admits that no heightened safety risk to firefighters or the public was presented by the accommodation previously in effect. 2.5 years passed without incident, and the firefighters continue to perform their job satisfactorily. The department's decision to abandon the prior accommodation was not based on actual safety risks to firefighters or the public. Rather, driving the calculus was bureaucracy. I should pause for a moment and just give the author of that opinion kudos. That's very impressive. So this is, by the way, one of a string of pseudofolliculitis barbae cases that are out there. They come in a lot of different flavors. Several of them come in the context of an ADA lawsuit, as does this Bay versus City of New York case. But others come in other contexts. For example, there's a Newark case that involved the Newark Police Department, where the department did in fact make accommodations for police officers who had PFB and didn't require them to shave. But then the next set of officers came around and said, our religion, they were Muslims, our religion prohibits us from shaving. The department said no to those accommodations. And a federal court said, hey, you've already established that having or some of your officers having beards is a reasonable accommodation. You've established that in the disability environment. you're going to have to offer the same accommodations in the religious discrimination environment. So different sorts of cases, but you know where they all come down to is, can the employer prove that the individual can't do the essential functions of the job with a beard? And that is becoming an increasingly difficult burden of proof for employers. Next up, we've got a new Weingarten case out of Pennsylvania that it doesn't really establish any new principles, but it does a good job, I think, of explaining some of the basic precepts of Weingarten and what an employer's options are. Weingarten, I assume everybody knows, but just in case, is the Supreme Court decision that holds that an employee who reasonably believes they could be subject to disciplinary action is entitled to union representation upon request. The Weingarten is a federal decision under the National Labor Relations Act. It's been adopted by state labor boards all across the country. And if you're in a collective bargaining environment, chances are Weingarten exists. So what's this case all about? Well, it involves SEPTA, the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transit Authority. That's the transit system in Philadelphia and the environs of Philadelphia. They have a pretty large police department, and the officers are represented by something called the Fraternal Order of Transit Police. This case involves an officer by the name of Mark Byrne, and others, but Mark Byrne most prominently. Byrne is a new officer. He was hired in December of 2017, he was hired 2.5 years ago. And in December 2017, he responded to a radio call that there was a man in the track area of one of SEPTA's trains. Four other SEPTA officers respond as well. The five officers get into some sort of altercation with the suspect, and they end up arresting him and then transporting him to the hospital. After all this happens, Byrne is interviewed by a detective, and the detective asks him some questions, types up his responses, and then asks him to sign the statement. And the department, on the basis of what Byrne and others had to say, initiated an internal affairs investigation. And during Byrne's interview, the investigator questioned him about a discrepancy between his statement to the detective and the footage that was available from platform surveillance and body-worn cameras. And after the internal affairs interview, Byrne is actually placed on restricted duty for 3 days. SEPTA takes away his firearm, removes him from patrol duty. And so obviously at that point in time, SEPTA thinks that Byrne is a suspect in potentially using excessive force in this encounter with the individual who was on the tracks. Well, eventually the IA investigation winds up, and what happens is that two of the other officers on the scene were fired, and the department began a criminal investigation into the incident. Byrne and the remaining two officers, remember we had five to begin with, were cleared in the internal affairs investigation. So now the criminal investigation is going on, and the department summons Byrne in for the criminal investigation, Byrne and the other two officers. The department says the same thing to all three officers. You have no right to representation because no disciplinary consequences can come out of your internal affairs interview. And the department also says that the officers won't be given Garrity warnings, but would be disciplined if they refused to answer questions or answer the questions untruthfully. Pause for a moment. The case doesn't talk about that last piece, and it probably shouldn't have because it's not relevant to the Weingarten issue. But can an employer tell officers, look, we're about to question you. We are not going to give you Garrity warnings. We are not going to order you to talk, but we will fire you if you refuse to talk? Or if you give us a statement and answer untruthfully, no, that's all messed up. If a department is going to order somebody to talk, whether in a criminal investigation or an administrative investigation, under any circumstances, if the department's going to order someone to talk, Garrity applies. And the statements of the officer and the fruits of the statement can't be used against the officer in a subsequent criminal prosecution. Not only that, most courts say that if Garrity applies, the employee has to be given Garrity warnings. So when the department here is saying to the officers, look, we're not going to give you Garrity warnings, but you got to talk, that's wrong. But let's glide past that because that's not what the subject of this case is about. So after the IA investigators say that to the three officers, the police chief puts in a personal appearance, meets with the officers and the Fraternal Order of Transit Police's president. And the chief says, look, IA's done. We did not conclude that you guys committed any departmental violations. You're in no jeopardy of discipline. And these interviews we're about to do are no different than the reports we expect from you on your day-to-day cases. You are not a target of a criminal investigation. The department then interviews the officers without union representation. The union files an unfair labor practice charge with Pennsylvania's Labor Relations Board, saying the denial of representation violated the officers' Weingarten rights, and the whole thing goes to hearing. And a hearing officer says, Weingarten clearly applies to these sorts of interviews, or at least ab initio it did, at the start it did. But then the department told the officers they could not be disciplined. And Weingarten writes, the right to representation turns on an employee's reasonable belief that they could be disciplined. Here, by assuring the employees that they would not be disciplined, here the department could effectively eliminate the right to representation. Here's a couple of lines from the hearing officer's recommendations that I think are the most salient. Where the employer gives the employee reasonable assurances that they will not be disciplined as a result of answering the employer's questions, generally the employee should rely on that representation and not have any fear of discipline. Where, however, the assurances are less than convincing, the right to representation still prevails. In this case, the record shows that SEPTA assured the three police officers who were subject to the criminal investigation that no discipline would result from the meeting. There is no credible evidence to suggest that the chief's assurances were less than convincing. Hence, no right to representation. I want to put two footnotes on that opinion, if I can. First of all, you notice how the hearing officer sort of used hedging language when he wrote those sentences that I just read you. So, for example, where the employer gives assurances that employees will not be disciplined, generally the employee should rely on that representation. What's the hearing officer alluding to? And he doesn't say, but it's pretty clear from other decisions in other states. What the hearing officer is alluding to is sometimes the employer can say you won't be disciplined, but it's sort of a Monty Python wink, wink, nod, nod thing where the employer then engages in behavior that's entirely to the contrary of what came out of the employer's representative's mouth. There's a wonderful case out of Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission where a department sat down with a dispatcher, and told her at the start of the interview that she would not be subject to disciplinary action, and then proceeded to conduct just about the most accusatory, threatening interview you can imagine. And Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission held, you know what? If the employer had actually behaved reasonably after telling the employee they weren't entitled to union representation, there would be no right to representation. But here, everything the employer said and did after making that statement, everything the employer said and did belied what the statement was, indicated to the employee that they could be disciplined, hence right to representation. So that's what that word generally means. Generally, the employee should rely on that representation. Footnote 2. You can tell I've been writing briefs lately. Footnote 2 is where the employer says to the employee, you won't be disciplined as a result of this investigation. The employer stuck with that. So employers better be careful before they make that representation to employees. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this next case. It comes out of Polk County, Oregon. It's another Brady case, and it's another example of an officer losing a lawsuit against a prosecutor for wrongful placement on the Brady list. I just want to tell you, I want to identify for you the two themes in this case that we're starting to see all around the country in these Brady list cases. So this case involves a deputy sheriff in Polk County by the name of Sean Laddie. The local district attorney, a guy named Aaron Felton, placed Laddie on his Brady list. The sheriff's department reacted by reassigning Laddie from patrol to corrections work on the grounds that he could no longer testify in court. Laddie then sued Felton, saying the reassignment deprived him of a constitutionally protected interest because he had a reasonable expectation of entitlement to his position as a patrol deputy and because his placement on the Brady list stigmatized him and harmed his employment prospects. A federal court wrote like two pages in dismissing this lawsuit. And what are the two essential grounds? There's really two and a half, but what are the two essential grounds on which the court dismisses the lawsuit? First of all, the court says prosecutors, at least in Oregon, and this is true almost everywhere, they are agents of the state when there is a criminal prosecution that is brought. It is state of Oregon versus Jones or Smith or whoever it is. They are state actors. And under the 11th Amendment to the United States Constitution, a citizen may not sue the state in federal court unless the state consents to the lawsuit, and here Oregon hasn't. Therefore, no possibility of a lawsuit in federal court under the 11th Amendment against a prosecutor. And that's becoming pretty standard law right now. What's the second reason the court dismisses the lawsuit? It's prosecutorial immunity. The court says prosecutor acting in his prosecutorial capacity enjoys absolute immunity from suits for money damages. And to the extent that Laddie's claims here are for money damages, and they were, those claims also have to be dismissed. Let me key in on those words, absolute immunity. There's different degrees of immunity in the law. There's qualified immunity. Absolute immunity are the two most common terms that you see. Qualified immunity is a type of immunity that people have that can be lost if they behave very badly. So, for example, if they act to intentionally harm somebody else, or if they act with reckless disregard of the harm that they can bring to somebody else, they will lose their qualified immunity and they can be sued. Absolute immunity means you can't lose that immunity. Even if you act intentionally to harm somebody, even if you act recklessly, in this case, even if Felton said, you know what, Laddie, I don't like you. You cut in front of me the other day in line at a Starbucks. I'm placing you on my Brady list. Absolute immunity would mean that Laddie could not sue Felton for wrongful placement on the Brady list. I said there were two and a half theories that the court used here. Remember what Laddie is really arguing here is sort of a due process notion that he had a right to a hearing before placement on the Brady list, before he was stigmatized in that fashion. And that ends up getting or the court ends up keying in on whether or not Laddie had a constitutionally protected property interest in his job as a patrol deputy. And the court said no, there is none. There's nothing in the collective bargaining agreement that covered Laddie that gave him such a property right. There's certainly nothing in Oregon state law that gives him such a property right, nor do we have any sort of idea how a district attorney, not the employer, could potentially impact that property right. So the case is gone. And this is the way lawsuits against prosecutors for wrongful placement on a Brady list come out. Law enforcement officers lose them. There's only a mild exception, and it's a mild exception. It comes to us from a decision of the New Hampshire Supreme Court. It's a mild exception where the only thing that the officer is suing for is to get removed from the Brady list, not suing for damages or anything like that, just is saying, look, my rights were violated by my wrongful placement on a Brady list. I need to be removed from the list. And there are a couple of cases out of New Hampshire that say that can be done. And I know there's cases going on around the country that are now based on the ruling of the New Hampshire Supreme Court. But that's about it. You can get placed on a Brady list. You can get fired because you're placed on a Brady list, and you can't sue the prosecutor who may have wrongfully placed you on that Brady list. That's the law. By the way, this is why, for example, we're starting to see state statutes around the country governing placement on a Brady list. We have three states, California, Maryland, and Washington, that have adopted statutes that say that an employer may not take adverse employment action against an employee merely for placement on a Brady list. The employer needs to show whatever it is the underlying misconduct is. We have another state right now, Arizona, that's considering a statute, at least it was as of a couple of days ago. The legislature was debating it, that would give officers due process rights before they could be placed on a Brady list. And certainly a legislature can do that if it's so inclined. So it's the harshness of the law in cases like Laddie's that I think is encouraging legislatures to say, you know, there's something wrong here, and we need to do something to fix it so that officers who are wrongfully placed on a Brady list have some meaningful job protections, because this could be the end of their careers. Next up, I've got an Illinois case. It's on a topic that's near and dear to my heart, which is, can a lawyer be sued or sued by a grievant for allegedly handling a case on behalf of a union in a negligent fashion? I've actually never seen this case or this sort of case litigated before. And I was real curious to see it pop up. And actually, the result kind of surprised me. I'm not sure it's the wrong result. I'll just tell you the result kind of surprised me. Okay, so what's this all about? This is about a guy named Russell Zander, who's a police officer with the Village of Fox Lake in Illinois. Zander does bad stuff, and the police chief files formal charges recommending Zander's termination. Zander's labor organization is the Illinois State Council of the Fraternal Order of Police, and there the state council actually has a labor function. I know in most parts of the country the FOP doesn't have a labor function, but it does in Illinois, and it's a pretty big one. They've got a fair amount of attorneys on staff, and the FOP assigns an attorney by the name of Roy Carlson to represent Zander. Now, Carlson is an FOP employee, and his job is to represent FOP members in grievance and termination proceedings. So Zander doesn't pay Carlson, right? Other than indirectly through his union dues. There's no formal attorney-client relationship between Zander and Carlson. And in fact, according to Zander, he didn't even want Carlson. The FOP forced him to accept Carlson. Now, under Illinois law, an officer who is facing discharge can get a hearing before the local Board of Fire and Police Commissioners, or if there's grievance arbitration available under the collective bargaining agreement, can file a grievance and go to arbitration. On Carlson's advice, Zander elects to proceed to arbitration, and he loses. After a two-day hearing, the arbitrator upheld the decision to terminate Zander's employment. Zander then sues Carlson, his lawyer, and the FOP, and he's basically alleging malpractice. What's the malpractice? Carlson breached his duty to Zander by advising him to waive his right to a hearing before the local police board and go to arbitration, and then later by inadequately representing him at the arbitration hearing. And that case ends up before the Illinois Court of Appeals. The court doesn't get into the merits of whether or not Carlson adequately or inadequately represented Zander at the hearing. So we have no idea what he's arguing about there. But the court does talk about the fact the other of Zander's claims is Carlson's advice to go to arbitration rather than a local police board was malpractice. And I will tell you, based upon my reading of the results in cases, many, many cases in Illinois, results in arbitration versus a local police board, is Carlson's advice to go to arbitration was precisely the right advice. So I think if the court here had ever gotten into the merits of the malpractice allegations against Carlson, at least the first of those, I don't think it was going to go anywhere. I think union lawyers around the country would probably say, almost uniformly, to the extent lawyers will say anything, almost uniformly, if you got arbitration, go to arbitration. Okay, back to the subject of the lawsuit. The Illinois Court of Appeals rejects the lawsuit, and it relies heavily on a case that doesn't come up very often. It's and we'll post it on our webpage. It's a U.S. Supreme Court decision that goes by the name of Atkinson versus Sinclair Refining Company. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that under a federal labor law, in this case the Taft-Hartley Act, a union's agents cannot be held individually liable for actions taken on the union's behalf in the collective bargaining process. Atkinson basically held that if a union has a duty of fair representation to someone, that duty is owed by the union, not by individual union employees or officers. I may go off on a sidetrack here. This is why, if unions are buying duty of fair representation insurance, and many of them do, particularly large unions, buy duty of fair representation insurance, you'll see an odd premium structure for that insurance. So it'll be a structure where the insurance company will say, okay, we'll provide DFR, duty of fair representation insurance, to you, and we'll provide it to the union for $10,000 a year. I'm making up that number, okay? $10,000 a year. And you know what? We've got a great deal for you. In addition to that, we'll provide duty of fair representation for your officers and employees for another $50 a year. So $10,000 for the union is going to be what your insurance premium is, $50 for the officers. How does that make any sense? It makes sense because under Atkinson, there is no liability for breach of duty of fair representation or breach of a duty of care on the part of union officers and employees. So what the insurance company is doing is charging $50 to insure against a non-existent risk. So that's what, just a little bit of an aside as to why you see that. seemingly bizarre premium structure if you're getting quotes for duty of fair representation insurance. So, anyway, Atkinson says you can't sue individual union members or employees, and the Court of Appeals in Illinois says, well, you know, Atkinson's a federal case. We don't have to follow it, but got to tell you, we think the principles of Atkinson are sound, and we think it is appropriate to extend Atkinson to attorneys who act on behalf of a union in matters arising under a collective bargaining agreement. And here's a couple of sentences that I think are at the heart of the court's opinion. And I'm quoting, as we noted above, a union may be held liable to a member for breaching its duty of fair representation only where it commits intentional misconduct in representing an employee. In a legal malpractice action, by contrast, an attorney may be held liable for merely negligent conduct. Allowing union members to file malpractice suits against union attorneys for actions taken in connection with the collective bargaining process would anomalously hold agents and employees of the union to a far higher standard of care than the union itself. That we cannot do. So, and then the court dismisses Zander's lawsuit against Carlson. That leaves Zander with only one claim, and the potential claim that the union breached its duty of fair representation in the way that that Carlson presented Zander's case in arbitration. And my understanding of the case is that's going to go back for trial. This next case I want to talk about is a case we're starting to see a lot of, whether or not prison prep time is compensable under the Fair Labor Standards Act. I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this because one of our premium podcasts that's coming up is with a management side FLSA lawyer named Lisa Charbonneau. And Lisa and I, in that podcast, talk at some length about these prison prep time cases. But I did want to give you the essential holdings of this case so you have a pretty good feel for what's going on with it. All of these cases are pretty much the same factually. They involve corrections officers, jail guards, whatever they're called. They have different job titles in different places. They involve corrections officers showing up for work. Then they have to go through security screening. And the security screening is predictably relatively intense. Then they have to get to their work sites, and when you have large prisons, that's a process that could involve transport by vehicle or it could involve a fairly long walk. During the course of the transport and after they go through the security screening, they are responsible, the employees are responsible for taking appropriate action if there's some sort of breach of security or there's a riot or something goes on. The corrections officers are expected to act and to deal with whatever situation is posed to them. Frequently, corrections officers will then go through a briefing period, usually a 5, 10, sometimes 15-minute briefing period. And then they will have to gear up. They'll have to get whatever protective gear that employer provides. And then they will get to their specific work site, and that's when they clock in. Then at the end of the day, they clock out at their work site, and then all that stuff that happened at the beginning of the time when they reported for work happens in reverse. They end up going through security screening again and before they're out of the facility and free to go home. And the question is that time between the security screening and when they get to their work site, is that work under the FLSA? And staring all the courts that are considering this case in the face is a decision from several years ago from the U.S. Supreme Court that everybody refers to as the Integrity Staffing case, Integrity Staffing versus Busk, I think it is. We'll put it on our website. And that's a case that involves whether or not going through security screening and walking to your job site is compensable for employees working for an Amazon.com subcontractor in a fulfillment center. And the Supreme Court, in a, you know, one of those typically divided votes with the conservative justices in the majority, said no, that's not compensable work under the FLSA because they're not hired. They, the employees who were working in the fulfillment center, they're not hired to go through security screenings. That's just simply incidental. That is not part of their regular jobs. So all of these courts that are deciding these prison cases end up facing the question of, are we like Amazon.com subcontractors, or are we different? And this latest case, which comes out of a private prison, by the way, it's operated by something called Management and Training Corp., and it's a prison that's operated for the state of New Mexico. This latest case is a big one. It comes from a federal court of appeals. We don't have many of these cases. We don't have any of these cases coming from a federal court of appeals. And we don't have an awful lot of FLSA cases comparatively coming from a federal court of appeals. It comes from the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. That has typically been a court that's not very employee friendly on FLSA cases. And the court says, prison guards, corrections officers in these circumstances are not like Amazon.com subcontractors. Here's what the court ends up saying. The employer conducts the security screening to prevent weapons and other contraband from entering the prison, and keeping weapons and other contraband out of the prison is necessarily tied to the officer's work of providing prison security and searching for contraband. Indeed, the security screening and the officer's work share the same purpose. And here comes you almost want a drum roll before you hear this next sentence. Because the time the officers devote to undergoing the security screening is integral and indispensable to their principal activities. Those of you who are versed in FLSA lore know that what the court is doing is quoting from the Portal to Portal Act there. Because the security screening is integral and indispensable to their principal activities, that activity begins their workday, and under the continuous workday rule, once the workday starts, all activity is ordinarily compensable until the workday ends. Thus, we hold that the time the officers devote to receiving the pre-shift briefing, picking up keys and equipment, walking to post, and conducting the pre-shift pass-down briefing is also compensable under the FLSA. That's the way the other huge case in this area came out. It's a case that was decided last year by the Missouri Court of Appeals. That case has now been appealed by the employer to the Missouri Supreme Court. And I suspect that's the way all of these cases are going to come out because, you know what, the job duties of a corrections officer are different than the job duties of an Amazon.com subcontractor employee in a fulfillment center. And going through security process and, all of these things like the briefing, they're very different. They're more meaningful. They're more related to the employee's job than would be the case in the private sector. So I suspect this case is not going to be anomalous. I'm also going to give you a short take on the last of the six cases that I wanted to talk about this month. It's a fairly standard discrimination case, but it's got a fairly interesting legal test that you don't see much. So what's this case about? This is about Tiffany Washington, who's an African-American woman who serves as a sergeant on the Metro Transit Police Department And it's the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority. So in other words, the buses and the subways, it's called the Metro there in Washington, D.C. Washington worked for the department's revenue collection facility in Alexandria, Virginia. And what she did, what her job was supervising lower-ranking officers aboard the money train. What's the money train? I love this case. What's the money train? It transports cash fares from metro stations back to the revenue collection facility in Alexandria, Virginia. Who knew that there were money trains? It makes sense, right, when you think about it, but man, I had no idea. So what happens? September 18th, our fated day in 2015, Washington left the facility, the collection facility, before the end of her shift. And after departing, Washington learned via text message that the money train had broken down. She was in sporadic contact with the officers aboard the train and also with an off-duty supervisor. But Washington failed to inform any on-duty supervisor of the breakdown for the next several hours. And as a result, nobody knew that these officers were stranded on the money train. No one got them food or water or attempted to relieve them, and they remained aboard the money train late into the night. And for that, the department demotes Washington to the rank of police officer, saying that he had lost confidence in her ability to perform in a leadership position. Washington sues, claims, that's not the real reason that I was demoted. It's because I'm African American and also because I'm a woman. Federal appeals court rejects it. And here's how you follow the bouncing ball in these cases. The first step is the employee a member of a protected class, and did they suffer an adverse job action? In this case, that's easy, right? Washington is the member of at least two protected classes, race and gender, and she was demoted. That's an adverse job action. Okay. Burden of proof shifts over to the employer. Does the employer advance a legitimate and non-discriminatory reason for Washington's demotion? And in this case, the court says, that's easy. Yeah, they did. What she did with respect to the money train, or rather what she didn't do with respect to the money train. And then these cases end up with the burden of proof shifting back to the employee, and the employee has to show that the employer's decision is a pretext. In other words, it has to show, in Washington's case, that there were deficiencies in the employer's thinking and that the real motivation behind the employer's action was an invidious discriminatory intent. And that, the court says, is challenging to prove. And here's why. The court rules, because it is not enough to show that the department's reasons were false, she must also show that the officials who disciplined her did not actually believe those reasons. Alternatively, Washington might establish pretext with evidence that a factual determination is egregiously wrong, because if the employer made an error that's too obvious to be unintentional, perhaps it had an unlawful motive for doing so. And in this case, the court says, Washington, her entire case turns on whether the employer's error in devoting her was too obvious to be unintentional. How's that for a legal test, right? Too obvious to be unintentional? And the court says Washington just simply didn't present such evidence. And here's the last couple of lines in the court's opinion. Washington didn't present evidence from which a rational fact finder could conclude that the department made an error too obvious to be unintentional. nor did she present evidence that those who disciplined her disbelieved their stated reasons for disciplining her. At most, Washington showed that the department could have credited her oral undocumented request for leave before she left her work site and absolved her of responsibility for later events, notwithstanding the evidence of another supervisor or the absence of another supervisor at the facility. But the department chose not to credit her oral testimony, and is a quote from the court's opinion, "We do not serve as a super personnel department that reexamines whether such a decision was wise, sound, or fair." We don't conclude that Washington's attempts to, quoting again, poke holes in the investigation in any fashion impugns the integrity or honesty of the officials who demoted her. So, interesting test, kind of a curious sort of case. I really can't remember ever seeing the error too obvious to be unintentional test. It seems like a very squishy sort of legal standard. Well, that's it for the March 2020 edition of First Thursday. Hope to see you next month when we're going to have an entirely new spate of cases. Next week, I'm going to be in Las Vegas where we do our annual collective bargaining conference. And then remember about that wellness and fitness conference that we have in mid-April that you can find out about at LRIS.com. With that, hope you have a great month. This is Will Aitchison signing off.